to an extremely good approximation, this is basically the situation that is described during inflation. And the mechanism by which the primordial fluctuations in space-time are created is basically a mechanism of particle creation due to the fact that we're looking at quantum field theory in a quasi-de Sitter space-time during inflation. So de Sitter space-time itself, of course, is a maximally symmetric space-time. In four dimensions, that means it's got 10 Killing vectors, just like anti-de Sitter space, just like Minkowski space. Actually, you can think of it in geometric terms, four-dimensional de Sitter, as a coset space, SO41, SO31. And all this really means is that SO41 here is the isometry group. So that's the group. That's actually the group which is built out of those 10 Killing vectors. So it's actually effectively the five-dimensional Rentz group that is the isometry group of de Sitter space. And that is made most transparent by the standard construction of de Sitter space, by where you take, you embed the four-dimensional de Sitter space in 1 + 4 dimensions. So you introduce an extra space dimension. I'll move over here because that'll get low. So you introduce an extra space dimension, and you consider the following surface embedded in five-dimensional Minkowski space. So I'll just write that as eta AB dxA dxB, where A runs from 0 to 4, and eta is minus plus plus plus. So this is the standard construction of de Sitter space. That surface, that four-dimensional surface induced in five-dimensional Minkowski space, is de Sitter space. It's exactly how you would construct a four-sphere, except there's a difference of sign here. So de Sitter space is actually just basically the same as a four-sphere, and then Wick rotated. And what we mean by Wick rotation is that basically the time direction becomes imaginary. Or equivalently, one of the space direction that defines the four-sphere becomes a time direction. And already that gives you the clue to some of the physics of de Sitter space. The fact that the Wick rotation of it is a four-sphere, and spheres are periodic things, is what it'll play out is that basically the Wick rotation, the Euclidean version of de Sitter space, will naturally be periodic in imaginary time, and being periodic in imaginary time is always the signal that you really have a temperature in your system. And so when you go back to de Sitter space, we'll see that just as in the Unruh effect, there will be a non-zero temperature seen by an observer in de Sitter space. But this is already hinted at in this geometric statement right here. So we can draw a picture of de Sitter space. Let's take this formula and let me rearrange it as the sum over xi squared from I equals 1 to 4 as h to the minus 2 plus x0 squared. When I should have said that 1 over h here is the length scale, and this is set up so that h is the Hubble constant, the Hubble scale, that we'll see represents the expansion rate of the de Sitter space time. So I can rewrite this equation in this form, just taking the time bit on the other side, so that now we have a sum of positive things as a sum of positive things, and it looks a bit more sensible. And you see, if on the right-hand side, if what you had is a constant, r squared, this would be the defining equation of a three-sphere. Just as before, if we take the sum of x squareds is r squared, that defines the equation of a three-sphere. But the radius of that three-sphere increases as square root h to the minus 2 plus x0 squared. So that means, so this thing is always positive because of the h to the minus 2. So it gets to a minimum. As x0 is greater than 0, it gets bigger. And also as x0 is less than 0, it gets bigger. And so you can draw a picture of that as follows. Essentially what you have is three spheres here, and I'm drawing a circle to represent what is really a three-dimensional sphere. And those three spheres are increasing in radius as you go forwards in time. So this is x0 is 0. This is increasing x0. And they also increase as you go backwards in time from that the special surface x0 is 0. Actually, that surface is not special because we could take this space, do a de Sitter transformation, so do a boost on it, essentially, and it'll still look exactly the same, and some other surface will play the role of this minimum area surface. Now, in this representation, this is called the closed slicing of de Sitter space. And what you see is what you've got is a collapsing universe. So basically the space, our space, not space-time, but the space is a three-sphere, and it's decreasing in size, so you've got a collapsing universe. Almost looks like it's coming into a singularity, but it doesn't. It bounces, and that's because of the curvature of the three-space allows it to bounce out, and you still have an expanding universe again. So it's a simple, exact solution of what sometimes people would call a bouncing universe. And you can see this more explicitly by using the following change of variable. So if I set x0 is equal to h minus 1 sinh h tau, and xi for I equals 1 to 4 is h minus 1 cosh h tau. And I plug that in. So this is that parameterization is such that it's guaranteed to solve that equation, because then we have minus x0 squared plus the sum of xi squared from I equals 1 to 4 is equal to, sorry, I forgot one guy there. So another variable, yi, so where we require that this variable yi sums to 1, then if we plug that in, we get h minus 2 sinh squared plus h minus 2 cosh squared, sum of yi squared. And if we define these guys to sum to 1, then we get cosh squared minus sinh squared, which gives minus h minus 2, and shows that that satisfies that relationship. So if you do that, this is a way of parameterizing the de Sitter space in terms of another set of coordinates yi that sum to 1. But of course, that just defines essentially the three sphere of unit radius. And if we plug that into this metric here and determine the induced geometry, what we find is the following statement. So this describes here, that's the metric on the three sphere, and then here is basically the scale factor in the closed slicing. It's a cosh, so it's something that for negative tau goes exponentially in a contracting way, and so for positive tau it goes exponentially in a very large tau, or very large negative tau. It goes exponentially with a different sign in each case, because depending on whether tau goes to positive, this guy will dominate. If tau becomes very large and negative, this guy will dominate. And this cosh here is clearly representing this expanding and collapsing universe. And this thing is just the metric on the three sphere. I'm just going to write it shorthand, d2 omega x s3. And as usual, we can parameterize that with some other set of angular coordinates that I won't go into, where basically the three sphere is sliced by two spheres, and then the two sphere metric is then in turn sliced by one sphere. So this is what, this is a particular parameterization for this sum. Okay, so in the closed slicing, we have this nice geometric picture of what De Sitter spacetime is. And we can also, in this slicing, it's the easiest actually to figure out what the Penrose diagram of De Sitter is as well. So when we construct a Penrose diagram, what we do is we take a space. Essentially what we do is take a space that might be infinite, and we want to basically take a conformal factor out and make the space effectively finite so that it's much easier to draw diagrams and look at the causal structure. And that's actually very simple to do here, because this metric is obviously conformal to the following metric, where this guy is basically R cross S3, and where I've defined a new time coordinate du, which is defined such that it's equal to 1 over cosh h tau d tau. And let me just check on scales and things. So there's actually a h to the minus 2 in there. I'll just get the dimensions correct. So there's an overall h to the minus 2. Sorry, h. So in that, with that choice of parameterization, u is actually a dimensionless variable. And I've taken the overall scale of the De Sitter spacetimes and put it out front. Now, you can see, just looking at side by that integral, this is obviously a finite integral. It's obviously convergent because it goes like 1 over cosh, so it easily converges. So u runs over a finite range. So you can put, so what we mean explicitly then is that u, we can set it to 0. It's for some value of tau. And I should put sort of tau there, gosh, h tau, as we integrate that up. Sorry, yeah, I didn't mean to put du there. So that finite range, if we plot the Penrose diagram, we put the finite range of u here, and then this direction is also finite. Of course, it's really a three-dimensional space. It's the three-sphere. But let me just draw a line, which is really representing just, say, one circle along that three-sphere. And so the Penrose diagram basically shows that the De Sitter space looks like, once you take out the conformal factor, it's basically just a line which has runs over a line or a segment which has finite range multiplied by a three sphere. U is. The whole range of t, so tau goes up to plus infinity, but the u is converging. I think it goes to pi over 2,
right.
And minus pi over 2, if I remember right. So u ranges over pi, actually.
The Penrose diagram has to be x-coordinate.
That's right. So if this was, for example, the theta 1 coordinate goes from 0 to pi, this would be 0. Well, this would be minus pi over 2 to pi over 2 with that definition. That's right. The phi coordinate, the range is different. Yeah. So it's actually a square when you do that. That's right. Okay. So this is the Penrose diagram. It covers the whole of De Sitter space, and you see, and now so you see that basically what we've done is taken out the contraction and the expansion, and we just have now the constant free sphere slices, taken out the conformal factor. Now we're almost never interested in this whole space-time, largely because it does describe a collapsing universe, and you know that's. Unless you're interested in somewhat alternative cosmologies, most of the time we're thinking about cosmology entirely in an expanding universe, and certainly we are doing that during inflation. So when we say that inflation is like De Sitter, we don't mean it's like the whole of De Sitter, we mean it's like just the expanding part of De Sitter, space-time. So we're only actually going to take half of this space-time, basically the half that corresponds to cutting the Penrose diagram into like that. So we're imagining, so we want to look for a system of coordinates that just covers that half space-time, and if that half corresponds precisely to cutting out the collapsing geometry region and just only taking the expanding geometry region. Now we can find a system of coordinates that covers that region. They probably look already very familiar to you, although how they're built into the embedding coordinates is somewhat more subtle, and that's the coordinates covered by the flat slicing. So in the flat slicing, the coordinates look like ds squared is minus dt squared plus e to the 2ht dx squared, where this is just a normal free vector. And that's basically representing a flat Euclidean space, which is now expanding exponentially in time as e to the ht, so set by the time scale is this constant again, the Hubble constant, which sets the expansion rate. And that's also, of course, in FRW geometry, the type of the type we've been considering our quantum fields living on, just as this guy is. And the only difference between them is that this is a closed universe, so it has positive curvature. This is a flat universe, and it has no curvature. And it's one of the weird features of De Sitter space-time, basically because it has so much symmetry that you can slice it in many different ways, and you can recover an FRW geometry that's closed geometry and an FRW that's flat, and you can even recover one that's an open geometry as well. Although we shan't be too interested in that particular case. And you can get these coordinates by embedding, by rewriting the embedding coordinates in terms of them as follows. So r squared here is just the norm x squared, and you choose x4. Did I call it x4? I did. Yes, I did. So these are how we take the embedding coordinates that describe the five-dimensional Minkowski space-time that we're embedding De Sitter in. And that's how you map, that's how you put, that's how you cover these coordinates that if you calculate, you'll find, adding these pieces together, that indeed it follows that these add up to minus H2, which tells you that you're correctly parameterizing the embedding surface that defines De Sitter space-time. And then when you plug in the metric, this is what you get for the flat space-time. Yeah.
The expanding slice that we're looking at.
Yeah.
That's also the slice that any observer can influence.
Right. So in the picture, let's imagine an observer who's sat at theta 1 is pi, which is, I guess, either which is the south pole or the north pole, depending on it. It doesn't matter which way we'd slice this. So let's imagine we've got an observer here. He will just travel along a geodesic that remains there. That's a consistent geodesic solution. So the slicing we're doing is also the causal region, which it's the causal region which the observer can influence. So that observer can send signals out and influence, send information to anybody in that causal region. And these coordinates cover that more or less something like this. So these are the constant t slices. But of course, there is another region. So there's always a region of the space-time where any observer can influence, but that's not necessarily the same as the region of space-time that the observer can be influenced by. So because in this diagram it's transparent that if you're over here, this is the end of time essentially. So but you can only send signals at the speed of light. So the most you can ever be influenced by is this region of space here, because anything that sends a signal out this way, the faster it can go is the speed of light. It'll get up to here, but it'll never influence this observer here. If we only take the half region of the space-time, then that corresponds to this line here. So this is the observer who's just sitting along, doing nothing, moving along a geodesic interstitial space-time. He can send signals out into this whole region. It could receive signals from this whole region, except we're going to throw away that part. That's what we normally do in cosmology, because we're not actually interested in the collapsing part of the universe. So then this is, in some sense, initial state here. And so it's only in this diamond region, which is called the causal patch, where you can simultaneously send signals to and receive signals back. And so you can actually have a conversation with people in this region, not with that in that region, though. So the flat slicing covers the whole of this region. So it covers more than you can ever actually communicate with in the entire time for de Sitter space to happen. There is another coordinate system which covers only this region. Now, just as in the Unruh effect, this surface here is really the past event horizon. It's actually a killing horizon. And this guy here is the future event horizon. Now, unlike in a black hole space-time, this is an observer-dependent concept. You have to pick your observer who's sitting along some geodesic, and then that observer can never know about what goes on in this region of the space. But another observer who's sat over here, they can know. They can know what's going on because they will be able to receive a signal from down here. So in de Sitter space-time, the horizon that we have, it surrounds us each as an observer, but we all have different horizons because there's we all have different regions of space-time for which we can both be influenced by and influence if we are ourselves located at different points in space-time. So the horizon in de Sitter is an observer-dependent concept, and that's why similarly the thermal nature of de Sitter is a completely observer-dependent concept. Unlike in the black hole case, where there's really just one horizon, everybody agrees on it, and the radiation you get there is not observer-dependent. It's there for everybody who's external to the black hole. That's one of the weird features about de Sitter space-time. We can make this map into the causal patch more transparent by doing another change of coordinates. Let me do that over here. So let me start in the flat slicing coordinates, and let me write the three-dimensional spatial sections in spherical coordinates so that this defines a two-sphere. Now, the trick is very simple. To go into coordinates that cover this region alone, you simply do, what you want to do is basically absorb this exponential expanding factor into that coordinate r, and so we define a new coordinate, capital R, which is e to the ht r. And in some sense, this is the physical coordinate. So when we parameterize an FOW space like this, the coordinates here are what are called co-moving coordinates. They don't actually represent the physical length. The physical length is measured by the metric, and the physical length is really e to the ht times r. And so when we do this transformation, we're really going to, this guy is really the physical length scale. And this is the guy you would call co-moving. Now, if we do that transformation, we get, through little algebra, that the metric is equivalent to that guy. And what I've done is note that basically we can write r is e to the minus ht capital R, and then dr is e to the minus ht r minus hr dt, dr minus hr dt, and then substituted that back in. Now already you see something quite surprising. In this coordinate system, it's now apparent that the metric doesn't depend on time. So already it's apparent that if I take t and goes to t plus c, and I keep r fixed, and I keep the angles fixed, that this metric is invariant under that transformation. Now that tells us we've got a killing vector. And since t looks something like a time coordinate, there's going to be some region in which that killing vector is time-like. And in fact, that region is precisely going to be the causal patch here in which that's, that killing vector is time-like. Now, this is kind of a weird thing. Well, how can we take a time-dependent geometry and suddenly find we've got a time-like killing vector? Well, in fact, you could see it over here. It's already more or less transparent. If you map that back, what that back is into these coordinates, the symmetry we're doing is we're taking t goes to t plus c, but at the same time we do x goes to x multiplied by e to the minus hc. So at the same time as shifting time, we also shift, we rescale space in the same way, then e to the 2ht dx squared goes to, we pick up an e to the 2hc from that piece, but we also pick up an e to the minus 2hthc from that piece, and those two things cancel, and then you see the metric is invariant, which is telling you that that is a killing vector. So there's some killing vector which is defined everywhere on the flat slicing, and it's defined everywhere on the whole spacetime. But it's not time-like everywhere, and of course that's the, just as in the Unruh effect, that's really the key to the presence of a temperature. This is going to be the time which an observer would use to define positive and negative frequency modes, rather than the time in the FOW metric itself. So we can simplify this guy a little bit further. To put it in a slightly more standard form, what we essentially do is, if I define f of r is 1 minus h squared r squared, is that function there, then I can, what we see is we've, what we've got here is minus f of r dt squared plus, and then minus a cross term, hr dr dt, and then plus dr squared plus r squared d2 omega on the two sphere. And we can introduce a new time coordinate that's linearly related to the old one and therefore still preserves the killing symmetry, where we don't basically define t is t plus. What we want to do is basically complete the square and get rid of this off-diagonal piece, so we want to shift t in such a way that we remove this piece, and the transformation is such that we integrate dr, and we have hr over f of r. To do that, doesn't matter what that is. That gets rid of the square. We complete the square, gets rid of the off-diagonal piece, and generates a new dr squared piece. And when all is said and done, the metric that you get is minus f of r dt squared plus 1 over f of r dr squared plus r squared d2 omega. And this is de Sitter space in the static patch, or causal patch. It's called static because, just as in T, because capital T is related linearly to little t, it's equivalently true that this metric is invariant under T goes to T plus C. That's a killing vector, and it's a time-like killing vector as long as f of r is greater than 0. What is f of r? It's 1 minus h squared r squared. So it's time-like as long as r is less than h minus 1. And that region, r less than minus h minus 1, is precisely the region that covers the causal patch, or static patch, of an observer. The surface r equals h is a null surface, r equals h minus 1, which actually is the event horizon. And so this, actually, the surface r equals h minus 1 is the thing we call the horizon in de Sitter spacetime. It surrounds us. We all have a different horizon depending on our location, but for each of us, if we were in perfect de Sitter, it would be some distance h minus 1 away in these coordinates. Yeah.
So an observer that is, I'm just wondering about the geodesics aspect. An observer who sees that the static patch is not boosting in any way, say, so he's producing a rocket.
Yeah.
That observer would just continue to see that static patch for the rest of his lifetime.
Yeah, an observer that's this is a geodesic, right? So what we're doing is we're setting up a coordinate system which singles out one person who's located at r equals 0. Now, if that person accelerates and we go and then goes to inertial again, then this coordinate system wouldn't be very useful for that because it wouldn't cover that whole region, right? So what we're doing is really covering, this is a coordinate system for one inertial observer in de Sitter spacetime. Just covers one person. As long as they don't move about, then it covers everything that they can ever know about. Yeah. Okay. But so the analog is really with the, this is analogous to what we have in the Unruh case, where we had the Rindler coordinate system when we were doing it in two dimensions, minus dt squared plus dx squared. And the Rindler coordinate system was the coordinate system that covered the region, the only region of space-time that the accelerated observer can see. This region, similarly, this space, which if you actually put in the coordinates, it looks something like that. So these are surfaces of constant capital T, whereas these ones are surfaces of constant capital R. Constant capital R coming out, and then eventually those surfaces become the time-like surface R is constant actually becomes null when you go out to the horizon.
For the static patch in de Sitter, the observer sees a spherical horizon.
Yes.
At a given
spherical horizon. Well, in two dimensions, it's so it depends on your dimensions, right? So, the analog is so. What do you want to say? So, here x is analogous to r, but the analogy is made more clear when you go into coordinates where this is rho squared dt squared plus d rho squared. But in this case, I think the horizon geometry is just a line, right? It's nothing special. I'm talking rubbish. The horizon is null, so the metric actually just vanishes on the null surface. So there is you know, the horizon, in a sense, the horizon is a point here, right? Whereas here, the point is that I can evaluate on the null surface. When I do, that goes to zero, but you still have a geometry left, okay, which is a two-sphere. So here, there's nothing left, which, that's right. Okay, so those are the most useful coordinate systems for de Sitter. And de Sitter spacetime is interesting about it is it realizes both the effects we've been talking about. One is the particle creation due to a time dependent background. So that was the original one we were thinking about, where basically when the effective frequency changes in time, then you get particle creation. Because basically what will happen is the WKB approximation for the modes will break down. And that's most clearly seen in the flat slicing. But it also realizes the second type of effects, which is the observer dependent notion of vacuum. And so that, and in particular, this is like the Unruh effect, we'll see that in vacuum, we see a thermal spectrum of particles. So let me consider first the first effect, where we will stick in the flat slicing for now, where the metric, and we'll stick it in conformal coordinates as well, because that's how we set up the previous formalism. So if you define the following conformal time, then you can show that this metric is basically the same as this is the coordinate system in which de Sitter space is conformally flat. It's conformal to Minkowski. Now, already, if you look at that map into conformal time, it looks kind of familiar. It looks very much like the map we did in the Unruh effect to map from the global coordinates to the coordinates that covered the region of the accelerated observer. There, the map looked like something like e to the plus or minus AX plus or minus. Sorry, that formula makes no sense. So here the map is that the conformal time is now exponential in the FRW time. Now, having got into this form, we can now just immediately apply the rules we've already derived, which is that if I think about a massless scalar field in 4D, then I know if I define the field as U over A, and I work in conformal time, then the equation of motion for U in Fourier space is just this equation, where omega k squared is m squared A squared, which is zero because then we're looking at the massless case, and then it's minus A prime prime over A, and then, of course, there's the k-squared piece as well. So this is the part coming from the effective mass, which you get from doing the conformal transformation, and then this is from the momentum. So in this case, what does A double prime over A work out to be? This is the formula. A prime here represents derivative respect to conformal time, and A of eta is actually minus 1 over h eta. And note that in these coordinate systems, t going from minus infinity to plus infinity corresponds to eta going from minus infinity to 0. That's a slightly annoying feature that the conformal time is always negative, but that's the way it plays out if you want to have conformal time increasing with ordinary time. That's the way the map works. So the scale factor is really minus 1 over h eta because the conformal time is negative, although that's not going to matter too much here because that'll drop out. So if we calculate a prime, we have plus 1 over h eta squared. A double prime is minus 2 over h eta cubed. So a double prime over a turns out to be 2 over eta squared. So the effective frequency for the massless scalar on de Sitter is k squared minus 2 over eta squared. Now, there are clearly two regimes when thinking about this problem. There's a regime in which this guy is small and that guy dominates. And there's a regime in which this is small and that dominates. Now, when this quantity is small, so when eta is large, so when, in other words, when mod k eta is large, much greater than 1, then in that regime, omega k squared is roughly k squared. And that, of course, is the regime in which WKB is a good approximation. Omega prime k squared or omega k squared will be much less than unity. That regime is when k is large, so that's when the wavelength is small. So that's at small distances. Small distances relative to what? Small distances relative to the horizon size during the sitter. Because you can see the combination k eta, I can rewrite that as k over a divided by h, given the formula for a is 1 over h eta. And what this is, k over a, k is the co-moving momenta. So k over a is the physical momenta. The physical momenta will be 2 pi over the physical wavelength. And then we're taking that and divided by h. And so I can equally write this as h minus 1 divided by lambda, with the 2 pi there. So this ratio here is the ratio h minus 1, which is the size of the Hubble horizon, size of the event horizon in de Sitter space, divided by the physical wavelength. So for this to be large, the wavelength must be smaller than the Hubble's length, the Hubble horizon size. And so we're talking at sub-horizon or sub-Hubble scales when this is a good approximation. And the fact that that's true is, this is always true, basically. At high momenta, you're going to small distances, but at small distances, you don't care that you're on a curved space because every curved space looks flat locally, apart from topological issues. Then because of that, that should also be the region in which WKB becomes a good approximation. That's also the region in which you have a well-defined notion of positive and negative energy modes. The other region, then, the other region is when k eta is much less than unity, then omega k squared is basically minus 2 over eta squared. And in this region, WKB is a disastrous approximation. And this, of course, is the region when the wavelengths are much bigger than the Hubble scale, h minus 1.
You're using the word beta, and these are not physical reasons. When it comes to the rate of curvature of the sphere, is always the same.
Yeah, I don't mean region of space. I mean range of momenta, I should say, something like that. Okay, so there's two ranges of momenta. There's high momenta where WKB is good, and there's low momenta where WKB is disastrous. Now, in terms of wavelength, that says for very... So the picture is that every observer is surrounded by a horizon or some... the H minus 1 here is the curvature scale in the sitter space. And that observer is using the flat slicing, which actually covers not only the region inside the horizon, but the whole thing, the whole space, and decomposing modes into Fourier modes on the flat slicing. And so some modes will have wavelength, which are much smaller than the horizon, will oscillate like that. And for those modes, WKB is a good approximation. But some modes will have a wavelength that's bigger than the Hubble size. And for these modes, WKB is a bad approximation. But in De Sitter, the Hubble constant is a constant. It's a maximally symmetric space. The curvature scale doesn't change in time. But the wavelength, the physical wavelength, grows with the expansion of the universe, just the normal stretching of waves. And so any wave that starts out at sub-Hubble scales, so that it's in the WKB regime, will get stretched and stretched and stretched until eventually its wavelength becomes comparable to the horizon size. And then it gets stretched even bigger. And as it's getting stretched, you get to a point where the WKB approximation starts breaking down. But you know when the WKB approximation breaks down, that's also the same point at which you effectively create particles. Because we need the WKB approximation to be good to even have a notion of what we mean by positive and negative energy modes. When WKB breaks down, then we don't have a notion of positive and negative energy modes, and that always translates into saying effectively that we have particle creation. Now, most of that particle creation actually goes on at the transition region when you get to when the modes get to the horizon size, and then they get stretched even further and further. But what happens then is that basically all the particle creation has occurred, and from then on they just scale in a particular way with powers of eta.
Suppose that you have some two observers.
Yeah.
And say out of the ball. Now, this has created this very high efficiency sort of, state, right?
Yes.
And that state at some point gets stretched out and it becomes like this, the wavelength is much bigger than the horizon size. And suppose Bob is outside the horizon, and then Bob will basically start seeing particles coming out of the horizon.
It's not quite like that. So because the problem is that because WKB doesn't work, so we have a picture here where we're in momenta space and not in position space. So this is not a real space picture. Okay, I'm talking about the wavelengths getting bigger than this scale. Now, this is really a cartoon in a sense for what's going on. In real space, of course, if you go outside your horizon, then in the region of the other observer, I mean, near them, WKB is still a good approximation, right? So it's not that, it's a Fourier transform thing going on, if you see what I mean. So what we really mean here is when the wavelengths are bigger than the Hubble scale, then you have particle creation. That's not the same as actually the physically going into the outside the horizon of one observer. Yeah. This reasoning, you're thinking? No. So if you have flat or anti-De Sitter, then you have a global time-like killing vector. So then there's always a notion of positive and negative energy modes in that case. Now, the feature we're capturing here is that in De Sitter space-time, we don't have a global time-like killing vector. So in a flat slicing that covers like half of the geometry, there is no time-like killing vector, so there's no notion of positive and negative energy frequencies. There is at small distances, because at small distances, you can never tell you're on a curved space, right? You have to go to tell you're on a curved space. You have to go out to the range over a distance of order the radius of curvature. So at small distances, you have a notion of positive and negative energy modes, but not when you range over the curvature scale of the geometry. Does that make sense? Okay, so this turns out this equation is exactly solvable in the massless case. And I'll just write you down the solutions. Basically, they look like the there is an analog of positive frequency modes, which look like 1 over root 2k 1 minus I of a k eta e to the minus I k eta. This mode is chosen. What we mean by positive frequency is if we're in the regime where k eta is much bigger than 1, then in that region, this guy just behaves like that, which is exactly the positive frequency WKB mode. So this mode is the exact solution of the differential equation that, for large k, becomes the positive frequency mode WKB mode. Similarly, of course, then we know the negative one is just the complex conjugate of this quantity. So this does define, if we have some definition of positive energy modes or positive norm modes, then we can use that to define the, a vacuum state. And so we can quantize our field. So remember, we took an overall 1 over eta outside, and then we stick a momentum space. We can use these modes to define a set of creation and annihilation operators. Such that they look like this. Plus the emission conjugate. It's normal. Where this guy, with this choice of positive frequency modes, the vacuum, which is annihilated by that quantity, is known as the Bunch-Davis vacuum. Now, this is the natural vacuum choice under sitter spacetime. In fact, you can make that more precise. This vacuum is actually invariant. Just as in Minkowski spacetime, the Minkowski vacuum is invariant under Poincaré transformations. This vacuum is invariant under de Sitter transformations. Meaning, the isometry group of de Sitter, SO41, meaning all those 10 Killing vectors you have under sitter spacetime. So let's think about Minkowski space. So you have some, so associated with every symmetry, there's some generator of that symmetry, right? So for translations, you have the momenta. So your vacuum state, you want to be in some sense a state that has zero momenta, right? And that's what it means, right? Because what it's saying, if I try and translate a distance on the vacuum, of course, I get back the vacuum. Yes. So you can. These are operators constructed out of the quantum fields that are the generators of the symmetry group. So that's just for translations. But for any symmetry you have in your problem, the statement that it's invariant, statement the vacuum is invariant, is that the generator of the symmetry annihilates the vacuum, basically. That's what we mean here. Okay, so we basically have a quantization. We have a specification of vacuum, which is more or less unambiguous because it's chosen by choosing the modes to be the modes which are positive frequency in their WKB region, the ones that oscillate like that, except we also know the solution away from the WKB regime. Now, given that, we can calculate the two-point function, correlation functions. So we can calculate something called the Whiteman function, which is basically, so let me call this vacuum the Bunch-Davis vacuum, which is the expectation value of the product of two fields, so the two-point function, in the vacuum state. Now, this, of course, shouldn't be confused with the Feynman propagator, which you do in normal Minkowski space, where you take something like the time-ordered product of two fields. This we're not doing. When you define the Whiteman function, you're not time-ordering. And time-ordering is only a useful thing, really, to do when you're thinking about scattering matrix calculations in out-formalism, but it's not actually very useful in cosmology, where you're really interested in expectation values of fields, usually at equal times, in fact. So the Whiteman function is basically just the expectation value of the product, the two fields, the correlation function. And we can now more easily calculate what this is, given these fields, and given the fact that we know that the creation annihilation operators should be normalized in the normal sense. That's what you'll derive when you demand that these things satisfy their normal commutation relations. And if we calculate this, it's the normal story that the part of this, A acting on the vacuum, gives zero by definition, so it's only the A dagger part that does anything interesting. Similarly on the other side. So this quantity, the Whiteman function here, W x eta, x prime, eta prime, ends up being, so you'll have two momentum integrals initially. You'll have a factor of 1 over a eta prime. You'll have a 1 minus I over k eta, 1 plus I over k eta prime. And then you'll have e to the minus I k eta plus I k dot x e to the plus I k prime eta prime minus I k dot x prime, and then an overall 2 k k prime. And so where all this is coming from is we're basically from the left hand side, we'll have one of these guys, because A acts on the left and gives something non-zero. On the right-hand side, we'll have the complex conjugate guy, because A dagger acts on the right and gives something non-zero. So what we've got is really the positive frequency modes evaluated at eta x multiplied by the negative frequency modes evaluated at eta prime x prime. Okay. So if you let's rearrange the and then we have of course the expectation value of AK dagger prime in the Bunch-Davis vacuum, and this thing will just enforce a delta function that K is K prime as normal. So this two-point function simplifies then into a single integral, d3k over 2 pi cubed. There's an overall 1 over, that was root k prime. There's an overall 1 over root 2k, 1 over 2k, from multiplying the 1 over root 2k's together, just as you have in Minkowski space. There's an overall 1 over a of e to 1 over a to prime, which gives you, remembering that a is minus 1 over h eta, that gives you an overall h squared on top, and then eta eta prime multiplied by 1 minus I over k eta 1 plus I over k eta prime e to the minus I k eta minus eta prime, now k is k prime, and then e to the plus I k dot x minus x prime. That's the two-point function, and it has a particularly interesting limit when you look at its behavior near eta and eta prime goes to zero. Now, what is that limit? Remember that the eta time goes from minus infinity to zero because of the map between eta and the FRW time. So looking at the limit as eta goes to zero is looking at the infinite far future, in fact, is looking at late times. Now, as eta goes to zero, these things are going to zero, but there's a 1 over eta and a 1 over eta prime here. So these guys are dominating. And in fact, we can basically just multiply that in and basically ignore the 1 here and ignore the 1 here because they become small. And in that limit, you get, and you have an extra k, you have h squared over 2k cubed, e to the minus I k eta prime, but I can neglect that. As eta becomes small, this becomes negligible, and then you just have the spatial part, x minus x prime. And this is an important result in cosmology, because what we've just derived is the power spectrum of fluctuations of a massive scalar field in a de Sitter background. And that's exactly what you have in inflation. You have an inflaton, you have an inflaton which basically more or less behaves like a massless scalar field in an almost de Sitter background. And this is the two-point function, the correlation functions of the inflaton. And what we derived is what's called the power spectrum, which is really just when you write the two-point function, power spectrum in general is just basically the amount of power in a given k mode when you Fourier transform the equal time commutation relation, which is what we have here. We just derived that the power spectrum P of k goes like h squared over 2k cubed. And this result is important because it's scale invariant. What do we mean by it's scale invariant? We mean if we take k and we rescale by lambda k, the power spectrum, so defined, goes like 1 over lambda cubed times P of k. But the power spectrum, to go to the actual fluctuations in the field itself, you integrate over 3k. So the measure, d3k, also scales like lambda cubed, d3k. And the two, the lambda cubed from here and the lambda cubed from here, 1 over lambda cubed from here, cancel out. And that's what we mean by saying that the fluctuations are scale invariant. There is effectively the same amount of power on all scales, because although the power falls off as 1 over k cubed, so as k gets bigger, there's less power per unit k. At the same time, as k gets bigger, the measure, the number of modes you've got for a given k, gets bigger, and the two effects cancel each other out. And so, and this is what we mean by scale invariant fluctuations.
So wouldn't that lead to a divergent
quantity? It absolutely does lead to a divergent quantity, yes. Now, so, yeah. So if that was the whole answer, it would lead to a divergent quantity. It does actually lead to a quantity that is divergent in the infrared. This is a well-known feature about de Sitter space. If you run de Sitter off for an infinite amount of time, then you do actually get a divergence, because you effectively got an infinite amount of inflation. Now, in the real case of inflation, we're only imagining a finite amount of inflation, and this thing will get cut off in some way. So scale invariant, if it was exactly scale invariant, of course, that would be a disastrous thing, because then you would have IR divergences. But it of course, in practice, it gets cut off. But you do have approximate scale invariance. And one of the most important predictions of inflationary cosmology is essentially this feature here, deriving this almost scale invariant distribution of fluctuations, which we know with some good accuracy are the correct sort of initial conditions for the early universe that we need to set up the density fluctuations, small scale density fluctuations that eventually grow by gravitational instability and produce the distribution of matter, of galaxies and everything we see around us today. Okay. All right. Yes.